welcome to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Adrian Tuttenham, and I'm going to be your guide as we ramble through a miscellany of sounds from the forgotten past. The first record today is a fake documentary, and a pretty transparent one by today's standards. But in 1905, when the gramophone was still scarcely more than an amazing novelty, some people might have been taken in by this. In any case, even those that realised it was a fake would probably have wanted to believe in it because it went along with the spirit of the age. It's called The Wreck of a Troop Ship.
Bugler, sound the fall in! Bugler, sound the fall in!
Attention, officers and men of the 74th Highlanders. In a few minutes, the ship will sink beneath the waves, and we who are men and soldiers of the King will be no more. We have faced death together before on many a well-fought field without shrinking. And as our enemy now is not man but God's element, it behoves us to meet the death that now awaits us with the same indomitable courage as of yore. Spoken like gallant soldiers and Scottish gentlemen. Sergeant, you sobbing?
It's no for myself, I'm thinking, but I'm a pair wife and we bairns of Liffetane. May God protect them frae harm and want. We all say amen to that prayer, Sergeant MacDonald. Let us now sing a verse of the old hundred.
All people
we will be standing before the great judgment seat. But we will go there in marching order. Officers and men of the 74th, I call for three cheers for His Gracious Majesty the King. Hip, hip, hip.
Hooray!
Hip, hip, hip.
Hooray!
Hip, hip, hip.
Hooray!
74th Highlanders, attention. Six bayonets. Shoulder arms. Present
That was Peter Dawson and Company in their representation of The Wreck of a Troop Ship, recorded in 1905. In his autobiography, Peter Dawson particularly remembers this recording. Apparently, the first take of it was ruined when the sound effects man became carried away with the enthusiasm of the moment and hit the thunder sheet so hard that it fell on the actors and knocked Peter Dawson out cold. Our next record might sound inexplicable to modern ears. But when it was made during the final stages of World War II, the grey dullness of the war had been grinding away for 5 years. With unremitting shortages, destruction, and the ever-present threat of death, people needed something to keep their spirits up, and the variety theatres and radio broadcasts provided this. Harry Lester had come over to England from the USA before the war, and he'd built up a crazy slapstick hillbilly act which would have been just as much at home in the circus as it was on the stage. Some of his family still lived in the USA, and they were able to send him a supply of the latest hit songs before they were released in England, which ensured that his act always stayed right up to date. Other members of his family were part of the troupe, along with such bizarre performers as Goofus, the yodeler on this record, who was discovered by Harry Lester at a talent competition in Great Yarmouth. On stage, their crazy antics had the audiences falling out of their seats with laughter. But even on such a restrained medium as a commercial gramophone record, their wild enthusiasm comes over with a vengeance. Harry Lester and his Hayseeds singing Bell Bottom Trousers in June of 1945. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. When that previous record was made, the Second World War was nearing its end and spirits were beginning to rise. But in the earlier days of the conflict, things did not look at all good. The defeat of Dunkirk would have started a downward slide in morale that could have lost us the war if propaganda hadn't been used to turn such a massive defeat into a kind of victory. The main news bulletin of the day was broadcast at 9 o'clock in the evening by the BBC, and a few days after Dunkirk, on Wednesday the 5th of June 1940, it was followed by a new 15-minute programme called Postscript. This was initially written and read by J.B. Priestley, the well-known author, and it was the first script he wrote which went on to become his most famous. In it he described the spirit of Dunkirk, where the remains of the British Army was rescued from the beaches by an armada of unarmed little ships, many of which were sunk by overwhelming military force, including one which he personally remembered from the happier days before the outbreak of war.
Among those paddle steamers that will never return was one that I knew well, for it was the pride of our ferry service to the Isle of Wight, none other than the good ship Gracie Fields. She has paddled and churned away forever. But now, look, this little steamer, like all her brave and battered sisters, is immortal. She'll go sailing proudly down the years in the epic of Dunkirk. And our great-grandchildren, when they learn how we began this war by snatching glory out of defeat and then swept on to victory, may also learn how the little holiday steamers made an excursion to hell and came back glorious.
That was J.B. Priestley's famous postscript broadcast after the Battle of Dunkirk, a record which I was fortunate enough to come across at a record fair many years ago. I'm following that with a much later postscript broadcast from October 1941, but as you'll hear, the next recording wasn't quite so easy to come by. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. Until the advent of the long playing record, playing time was limited to 3.5 minutes for a 10-inch record or 4.5 minutes for a 12-inch. Longer items, such as symphonies, were issued as sets of records bound together in a cardboard folder called an album. Less prestigious recordings were also issued as sets, sometimes of only 2 or 3 records. And there are few things more frustrating to a record collector than finding a set of really interesting records with one missing. For years, I was the owner of just one out of a pair of records that made up one of the most fascinating broadcasts I have ever heard. It was the reminiscences of a British seaman whose ship had been sunk during the war, and it had been copied by HMV from a BBC recording made in 1941 and then issued to the public. During the war, records were not easy to buy, and they were often recycled to conserve scarce materials. So the chance of finding the other disc of the pair was quite remote. One day I had gone to a City of London Phonograph and Gramophone Society record fair in Northampton, with a friend called Alastair Murray, another mad collector of records. By the end of the day, we had spent far more than we planned, as one always does at these events, and the car was weighed down with boxes of goodness knows what records, when Alastair decided to have one final look around. The traders, who were in the throes of packing up, were not exactly pleased, and I was waiting to start on our long drive home. Suddenly, as if guided by some unseen force, Alastair dived into a box under one of the trestle tables and emerged triumphantly with a disc which he thought might interest me. It was, of course, the missing disc of the postscript set that I'd been trying to find for over 10 years. I'm sure when you hear it, you will agree it was worth the long wait to complete the set. This is going to be our last record for today, so this is Adrian Tuddenham thanking you for listening and looking forward to having your company again next week. In the meantime, here is a piece of propaganda which doesn't gloss over the ugly truth and gives you some hint of what the war really was like. Seaman Frank Laskier describes his experiences, first broadcast as a postscript to the BBC 9 o'clock news on the 5th of October 1941.
I'm a sailor, an Englishman, and my first name is Frank. I'm quite an ordinary sort of individual, all we sailors are. We have our job to do and we do it. You can see me or my mates anywhere in the whole world. You can find us in Joe Beef's saloon in Montreal, or you can find us dancing in the Trocadero in Brisbane, or you can find us getting slightly kettled in Jack Dempsey's bar in New York. We don't wear any uniform. We wear a small silver badge. Well, a long time ago I had 3 friends, 3 shipmates, 3 schoolmates. In 1938, we came back and we decided that as we were all great friends, we'd have a holiday ashore. We had a marvelous time. We were happy and we were sunburned, and Charlie had his wife. And I always look back on that as a sort of calm before the storm, of this storm. You see, to digress for one moment, Charlie and I were very great friends, and we both fell in love with the same girl. Well, she was a very, very wise girl. She chose the infinitely better man. She chose Charlie. Okay, I came to their wedding. I was Charlie's best man. We had a marvelous time, and they were both happy. Of those four men, I sit here now with a funny little grotesque stump where a perfectly good right foot used to be. Billy was blown to hell on a minesweeper. George went down with a courageous. Let me tell you what happened to Charlie. Charlie was on my ship, and we signed on, and he was very, very unhappy when we had to push off. We went out in convoy, and we faced the dive bombers, and we faced the submarines. And later, the convoy sort of broke up, and we went our various ways. We settled down to the ordinary routine life of a ship at sea. And one night, 800 miles from land, I was on watch on the gun at 6:30, and it was pitch dark on a tropical night. Suddenly there was a shot and a bang, and into the air there shot an enormous great yellow flare. I turned round and made one wild dash for the gun, and as I got to the gun, suddenly an absolute holocaust of shells burst around us. They were firing on the starboard beam, complete broadsides. 6 11-inch guns and 8 5.9-inch guns. Quick, up to the gun, open the breech, ram the shell, put the charge in, put the tube in, close the oven door, run to the trainer, train around, quick, quick, crash, the shells are banging into us. Round she's trained, the lights are there, try and get on that searchlight, duck under the middle, put your range on, bring it down, pull the trigger, bang went old Mildred. It was heaven. Back aft, open up again, put the charge in, and then there was a crash like the opening of the gates of hell. I was thrown about 6 feet. I picked myself up, and there just wasn't any gun worth speaking of left. Up to my feet, round the poop, down the ladder, across the well deck, stepping on a bloody gruel of men's bodies who'd been smashed as they came out of the poop. Up the ladder, along the upper deck. God, where's the bridge? There isn't any. A captain shouting, abandon ship. The great glaring eye of a searchlight is blazing down on us. I turned to go aft. And there on the deck was Charlie. But it doesn't matter, Mary. There are a lot of people listening to this, and they will remember. When you think of a raft, you nearly always think of the illustration by Defoe of Robinson Crusoe on his raft. You know, a collection of boards tied together with a mast and a sail and a shirt and a couple of packing cases. But that isn't a raft. The raft that we had been on when our ship had been sunk was the size of about 6 orange boxes lashed together. Empty oil drums were in the middle, and the sea was like green glass with beautiful lights of phosphorus underneath. And we went over the side and swam, and there were sharks, and we knew there were sharks. In a crazy hysteria of fear, we crawled under the raft. I remember them so well as they came on. There was Mac, wounded, and Mac David, the second engineer. You know the old story by Kipling that you've only got to go down into the engine room of any ship east of Suez and shout Mac, and someone is bound to come up. He was there. The junior Sparks was there. The two little midshipmen were there. I was there, and the extra fourth mate and the skipper and the chief engineer. We huddled together there on that raft. And there were shouts and shouts. Let go the painter. She was tied to the boat. She was tied. And the boat was going down. We could see her going down. And suddenly someone found a knife and slashed and hacked away at the painter. And the raft floated free. And we lay there on the raft, wounded, horribly wounded. And suddenly, without any cause or reason whatsoever, the raft overturned. Just imagine to sit and feel the raft slipping and slipping from underneath you and the water getting close around you, and then suddenly the raft has overturned. But we got back. The skipper got back, and the chief engineer, and they grabbed hold of poor old Mac by the scruff of his neck and dragged him on board, and they dragged me on board. And from somewhere or somehow, they picked up another boy of the crew and dragged him on board. And we watched our ship sinking. I was very, very fortunate. I was on the raft, and I had been, let us say, so seriously wounded that I was losing consciousness. But I remember two or three things that happened to me, and I don't think I'll ever forget them. The warmth and the security and the infinite love and tenderness which one man, I never know who it was, kept his arm about me the whole time to prevent me from slipping off. I remember Mac David the second, as he sat on the far end of the raft with that little oar about 3 foot long, smacking away to scare the sharks. I remember the sharks, blue and green and grey, as they swept up from the depths of the ocean to make huge, vicious snaps at my legs. I remember the grasping, rasping sound as they scraped along the bottom of the raft, but they didn't get us. And all that night, and all that day, and all the next night. I wonder if you can understand what I mean when I say that. All that night, 12 hours. And that day, 12 hours. But throughout the whole of that time, the wounded did not complain and the healthy helped. Throughout the whole of that time, the skipper was never referred to as anything else other than Sir. There were no complaints, there were no faintings. We stuck it, holding on, for we knew that our raft was sinking. Those oil drums had been pierced with machine gun bullets. And then, the smoke on the horizon, and the little midshipman, our first trip midshipman, he stood up on that raft and balanced himself on 10 feet by 8 of drifting planks and put his coat through his oar and waved it and saved our lives. And I lay there on the raft as the Spanish tramp steamer came alongside, and they lowered an enormous great fish basket to put us in. And I saw the basket coming closer and closer, and I lifted myself and balanced on one leg and made a wild grab at the basket as someone suddenly seized me by the seat of the trousers and lifted me inside. Just as I left the raft, there was a horrible burning, stinging pain went through my left foot, my remaining foot. It wasn't until later that I found out what it was. The sea had made a last bite at me. I'd been stung by a jellyfish. You know, there's always, in some indefinable way, been an antagonism between members of the Navy and the merchant service, because we're both doing the same job, and both do it in an entirely different way. Let me tell you how I last met the Royal Navy. I was on that Spanish tramp, and I was very, very sick indeed. I had been 3.5 days without any medical attention whatsoever. But that's beside the point. I was sick. And as I lay in my bunk in the little hospital of this tramp, a man came in and said to me, "There's an armed merchant cruiser on the horizon." And I remember I sort of passed out after he said that, because when I came to, instead of finding my little cabin so calm and so bare, it was full of men, full of sailors. And I remember that I felt as though a man were putting binoculars in front of my eyes, because one moment everything would be large and the next moment it would recede to a tiny little pinpoint. I was getting delirious, I suppose. And as I lay there, utterly helpless, gazing at them, suddenly they seemed to part, and a man pushed his way to the front, and he wore the red and gold epaulets of a surgeon in the Royal Navy, and he leaned forward. I'll never forget him. He'd even found out my first name, because he got hold of me so gently by the arm and shook me and said, "Don't worry, Frank. We're here. We'll look after you. Now, don't worry. We're going to put you to sleep now." And they rubbed my arm with spirit and injected morphine into me. Oh, it was heavenly. All the grinding, searing pain had gone. I felt as if I was floating away on the top of a cloud, and they lifted me and whisked me outside and cut away my clothes and wrapped me in a blanket and carried me in a flexible stretcher and laid me down on the deck just by the gangway, ready to lower me into the boat and safety. And as I laid there on the deck of that steamer, under God's blue sky, and I looked and saw my skipper with the light of hope shining in his eyes, and Mac dreaming away in morphia, laying there beside me, safe, and all the rest of the boys who'd been on that raft. And I saw in front of me the huge mass of that armed merchant cruiser, and standing by me, two men in the spotless white of the Royal Navy. Suddenly, something peculiar happened to me, something I've never experienced before in all my life. I had a funny sort of constricting pain in my chest and a burning sensation in my throat and my eyes. It had never happened before, and I didn't know what it was, but I found that I was crying. I was crying. I missed my friends. I missed the men who had helped me. I lay there on the deck of the ship, watched over by the Navy, and I cried in grief and in happiness and in safety.